Hello, and welcome to the first episode of That's So Ravenloft, a podcast dedicated to 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons horror and dark fantasy gaming in the dread domains of Ravenloft and beyond. My name is Megan.
And my name is Deanna.
Hello, Deanna. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Megan.
If anybody is listening to this on the day it premieres, hopefully we'll maybe get like ourselves and 5 other people listening to it on the actual day it premieres. But if you are, happy Halloween. Because you should be listening to this on Halloween Day.
Make it spooky.
Are you doing anything special on Halloween Day? I know that I ruined your pumpkin carving by demanding that you record with me when you were supposed to be with your family.
Yeah, it's true. You did do that. But I am trapped in your basement. So what can I say?
It's got good acoustics. That's why we record down here.
It is great.
Do you have anything special that you're doing on Halloween Day?
Praying that trick-or-treaters don't show up so I can eat all the candy.
Yeah, that's kind of my plan too. I thought about putting up some like purple and orange Halloween lights around my window, but even that seemed like just a monumental task that I'm not capable of doing.
I'm a millennial adult. I don't do things. I record podcasts.
I was thinking you should like get little costumes for your ferrets.
I do have sweaters for them. They do not wear them. And it's funny to watch them escape the sweaters.
Are they Halloween-themed sweaters, though?
No, they're not. They were a birthday gift. For
their birthday or your birthday?
My birthday. I was also gifted a pair of socks with ferrets on them.
So somebody gave you sweaters for your ferrets for your birthday?
Yes.
But you can't wear them.
No, but I can take pictures of my ferrets in the ferret sweaters, and that is a gift to me and me alone.
Well, once we get the Twitter account up and running, we'll be sure to put some of those pictures on there because I'm sure the listening audience is demanding to know.
They're demanding their pictures. Like.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Twitter, why don't we plug ourselves? Why don't you tell us your Twitter handle for people that want to find you?
For anyone who wants to find me on the internet and wants to see my unhinged ramblings, you can find me at Deanna Writes Inc. I-N-K.
And you can find me on Twitter at Miss Megan J, M-E-A-G-H-A-N. Got a whole bunch of extra letters in there just to make things more confusing. I'll probably put links in the show notes too, though. So if you're not sitting there with pen and paper furiously scribbling down everything I say, then you can go and look it up afterwards.
But you should be. That is what I do.
Yes, I expect everybody to take notes on this podcast. That's what it's for. It's not so much a podcast that I expect people to listen to for personal entertainment. So much as homework.
Now, this is a lecture.
This is part of the Great Courses series. I'm a professor of Ravenloftology, and you are my grad student. Let's talk about the podcast sort of in general, like what the idea is for this show. And I will say that probably the format that we have is going to evolve and change over time. So don't hold us to anything that I say right up front. Because it may change. But generally speaking, the idea for this podcast is to be 5th edition centric. So there's been a lot of different incarnations of Ravenloft in 1st, 2nd, 3rd, not 4th, but 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th edition have all had their own variations of Ravenloft. They all have their pluses and their minuses, but we are going to focus on 5th edition Ravenloft. And anytime that we go into lore or background for the other editions, I think the idea is kind of be like, how can you take what's in this lore and make it work in 5th edition?
So we're all going to learn together.
Exactly. And then the focus is going to be sort of on like, at least to start, is going to be on lore. So like the different settings, different characters, monsters, and history. But also we're going to do episodes on like advice for running campaigns, maybe like campaign breakdowns. And while the show has Ravenloft in the title, I think that we'll eventually expand into other settings as well, because there's other horror settings beyond Ravenloft. There's others in D&D, and then there's third-party settings, there's Pathfinder settings, and maybe we'll even dabble in like Call of Cthulhu at some point.
I like to call it Cthulhu.
I know. So we'll start with Ravenloft, but we'll branch out in time.
There's a lot of Ravenloft to get through.
There is a lot of Ravenloft. We don't have to get through every little single thing about it, but we'll start there, get through the most important stuff, the best stuff. And then if we feel so inclined to expand outward, then we can. It's our podcast. We can do whatever we want.
We're in charge.
And I have vague plans to do an actual play at some point. I am not 100% committed to that. So don't sue me if it never materializes, because actual plays are a ton of work, but it's something I would like to do. So that may be on the horizon in the future. Just something to keep in mind.
We know I have no experience with actual plays. Never done one.
Yes. Well, you will be the star of my actual play.
Oh no.
You'll be the main character.
Do not give me that kind of power. I will only abuse it.
Let's talk about what is Ravenloft, because I think it's important to establish sort of what the canon is for 5th edition and sort of what we mean when we're talking about Ravenloft. Because like I said, there's so many different incarnations over the different editions that it's not necessarily going to mean the same thing to the same person who hears it. In a nutshell, Ravenloft, 5th edition. Ravenloft is a demiplane that exists within the Shadowfell, which is kind of like the dark inversion of the prime material plane within the grand D&D multiverse. Ravenloft is kind of like a little dimension unto itself. I think of it like a snow globe. That's sort of in my own mind. That's how I think of it.
Oh, like I love that.
Yeah, like these domains of Ravenloft are kind of floating around in this bubble filled with mist.
Halloween snow globes.
Yeah, Halloween snow globes. Perfect. And each domain is sort of a self-contained unit unto itself. Each domain has a single Dark Lord who rules over it, although there are exceptions where there's more than one. And actually, I think there's one where there is no Dark Lord. But for the most part, the general rule is that one domain, one Dark Lord. And the Dark Lord is kind of like the metaphysical ruler of the domain, although they're not necessarily the actual political ruler of the domain. They might not have temporal power, but they have a unbreakable connection to the domain itself that gives them sort of immortality and also great power, including the power to seal off the domain. So in theory, if you get to the edge of the domain, there's just mist, and you walk out into the mist, and you may or may not eventually arrive in another domain.
Yeah, I was reading what can happen when you're in the mist, and it's like, yeah, sometimes you go somewhere else. Sometimes you just end up tormented for 1d6 hours. And I was like, oh, good.
Yeah, there's sort of an idea in 5th edition that if you have like an item that's from another domain that you can kind of focus on, that you can use that to arrive where you want to. So if you're in one domain and you have like a souvenir from Barovia, you can just sort of fixate on this souvenir and walk through the mist, and you'll eventually wind up in Barovia. And that's sort of the idea. And there's people called Mistwalkers who can travel at will from one domain to another. So there's ways to get around, but generally, and there's even modes of transportation, like things that go from, there's the Morning Rail, which is like a train from Eberron that travels from one domain to another. There's a boat called the River Dancer that travels from one domain to another. And there's even little mini domains that travel to other domains, like the House of Lament, which is basically a haunted house that can appear in any of the domains. And there's a traveling carnival that can travel to all the different domains.
Oh, so literally just the spookiest thing.
Yeah. And so there's ways to get around, but basically if the Dark Lord has the power to seal everybody inside if they want. Ravenloft overall is governed by these forces called the Dark Powers. And what the Dark Powers are and what they want is kind of like up to the DM. It's really left open-ended. Are the Dark Powers gods? If so, what gods are they? And sort of why are they doing this? I sort of think of it as the Dark Powers are not quite gods. Like they're like a step below gods, but within Ravenloft, they have the power of gods, basically. But it's really complicated. Nobody worships them. They don't directly interfere in like a tangible way. It's sort of like they look out at the general multiverse, find somebody who's super duper irredeemably evil, pluck them out of their home, put them in this domain of Ravenloft, create the domain around them, and trap them inside to be tormented over and over again for all eternity.
So they just take the most evil people in the multiverse and just put them in a little terrarium and go, all right, have fun. Do whatever.
Yeah, pretty much. And they talk about the dark powers being evil sometimes, and I suppose they are, but I like to think of them as sort of like a lawful evil in the sense that they're really more like they're punishing people, but they're punishing evil people is sort of their main focus.
Yeah, but also a bunch of innocent people, because normal people exist in the, well, kind of, normal people kind of exist in the Dread Domains.
Yeah, and they just kind of get caught up in it. Evil with a purpose. How about that? Does that make sense?
Most bizarre and specific jail you've ever been inside.
This is another thing that's kind of nebulous, but the way that I run it is that there's no gods in Ravenloft. The dark powers keep other gods from entering. It's, you know, part of the snow globe. It prevents the gods from coming in and interfering. And this makes things a little bit tricky, because if you're playing as a cleric, let's say you're a cleric of Lathander, the Morning Lord, you don't really have access to your god or to your god's power. And the idea is that the power that you think you're channeling from your god, you're actually channeling from the dark powers themselves, who are sort of letting you channel that power just to confuse you and fuck with you.
They see you channeling another god's power, and they're just like, all right, let's see where this goes. I'll allow it.
Yeah, so like cleric power can sometimes not work properly. That's how I run it in my games anyway. Like if you're a good cleric, like a light domain cleric, and you try to use your spells, they work on a mechanical level, but they're going to be weird. You know, they're not working properly. They might look weird or behave weird, just to give it a little sense that not all is well.
Note to self, don't play clerics in Megan's Ravenloft campaigns. Got it.
And I made the mistake once of telling a player who is interested in joining my campaigns that that's how I do it, and they did not like that. I was like, oh, and now I just kind of leave it ambiguous. In my own mind, even though I might not say it explicitly at the table, your god does not hear your prayers in my game.
Yeah, if you're listening and you play in one of Megan's campaigns, no, you didn't. You didn't hear anything, and that didn't happen. It was weird that we went to static for like 7 minutes, and now we're back.
Now, let's see. Is there anything else that I want to say particularly about the 5th edition canon? Dark powers at the top, snow globe, different domains floating around in the mist. You can travel between the mists, but there's restrictions.
Dark Lords are there. They're kind of in charge and kind of not. They think they're in charge.
They're in charge, but they're also prisoners. But they're also sort of prisoners of their own making. You know, the Dark Lords don't find good people and turn them into Dark Lords. You know, the Dark Lords are what they are because of the choices they made.
That was the hardest part, learning about Ravenloft. That was my hardest reckoning, was like, the Dark Lords are irredeemably evil. And it's like, no, I can fix them.
You can't fix them. At least that's the idea. Them. I mean, as with all things Dungeons & Dragons, if you really want to play around with it, you can. But strictly speaking, you can't redeem them, and they also can't really be killed. Sort of, if they get killed, they just reappear. Although there is, I mean, DMs can kind of play with that, have them get reincarnated or replaced, but there always has to be one Dark Lord for one domain, with a very rare exception.
Yeah, everything we say with a grain of salt, your table is your table, you know your table best.
Yeah, and one of the fun things about Ravenloft is that it really leaves it open. The lore is a bit more flexible than it is in a lot of other settings, so you can kind of play around with it, which I think is fun. So the next topic that we're going to go over, the central focus of this episode, is going to be a general look at the history of Ravenloft as a setting. So not the history of, you know, in year one, Strahd did this, and in year two, Strahd did that. We're sort of like a publishing history. So it started in 1983. Well, the first edition was published in 1983. It was published for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, first edition. And it was written by Tracy and his wife and co-writer, Laura Hickman. And according to lore, according to what Tracy Hickman himself wrote in the introduction to Curse of Strahd, he says that he was playing a game of Dungeons and Dragons in his, I think, in the late 70s. And it was sort of like a typical dungeon crawl. I mean, this is 70s D&D when it's very just you are a pile of numbers that walks through a dungeon and fights other piles of numbers. So he was doing this dungeon crawl adventure. And at the time, the dungeon master was using like random tables to generate what monster was going to be in which room of the dungeon. And
that's
so he's
dangerous.
Yeah. So he's traveling through. It's like you can either get one skeleton or a red dragon.
Yeah. It's like, why would you do that? That I'm a control freak. So doing that, I would have no, I couldn't do that. Like, I have to plan everything ahead.
That was the old school way of doing things. And there's vestiges of that still around. Like, I don't know how often people use random tables, but I mean, that's why there are random tables in modern books. That's why there's like experience points in modern books. It's just kind of a remnant of those days.
I like to look at the tables. I find them fascinating. But if you asked me, like, roll on a random table to see what happens, I'd be like, I can't. You don't understand how badly I cannot do that. I will have a breakdown.
But anyway, I mean, this is kind of, I mean, what you're saying is kind of what triggered the creation of Ravenloft, because the dungeon master rolled the dice and what popped up on the table was a vampire. So they're fighting in this dungeon, presumably deep underground, and suddenly there's a vampire there. According to the story, Tracy Hickman found this very out of place. Absolutely. Like, what is a vampire doing by itself in this, you know, down in this dungeon? The idea that his idea was that a vampire should have a backstory of some kind, and it should like exist within an ecosystem, which kind of makes sense. I mean, what is a vampire doing in a place where there's no people to drink blood from?
My reasoning would be that thing where you go to take a nap and you're like, I'll sleep for like 15 minutes. And then it's been 6 hours. Like, maybe the vampire, he like went to go take a nap, and then suddenly it's been 100 years and they've built this dungeon on top of him.
Oh, that's a good point. Maybe he was just, I mean, I don't know the details of that adventure. Maybe he was like asleep in his coffin and just nobody woke him up for 100 years.
No one woke him up. That he was like, wake me up in like a decade for a snack. And then everyone was murdered and they built a dungeon on top of him. He's just confused.
Yeah, he's confused. He wakes up. He's grumpy. He's got like, you know, when you wake up and you're kind of like half dreaming and you're confused about where you are. And suddenly there's some adventurers attacking him. Tracy Hickman was like, okay, well, I can come up with a better vampire-centered adventure. So he and his wife, Laura, started working together to create an adventure that was centered around a villain. A villainous vampire. And they wanted this vampire to have personality, to have specific motivations, to be as intelligent as the players, not just a mindless monster, and to have player abilities, which was something that was, an innovation. So the vampire that he came up with, of course, is Count Strahd von Zarevich, or Zarovich, as some people say. And he was a vampire with a backstory, a personality, his own goals, and also he's a spellcaster. So that was kind of an innovation, like a vampire that could cast spells.
A villain that is as versatile as your players.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they were going for. They thought it'd be more challenging if you have a villain, an enemy who's more like a player, which makes sense, which is why players mop the floor with most monsters, because they can do so much more. So they created this adventure called Ravenloft, which created the village of Barovia, the castle called Ravenloft, where Strahd lives. And they came up with the story. The idea is that you're these players who find yourselves trapped in this land, Barovia, which is surrounded by mist. You can't escape. There is a story about a young woman named Irina who has come to the to the Count's attention, and he sees her as the reincarnation of his lost love, Tatiana, whom he's sort of murdered. And the rest of the adventure is basically you have to go to Sarad's castle and kill him so that you can protect Irina and so that you can get yourself out of Barovia.
Back in the day, could you actually kill Strahd? Because, he would just be dead. Interesting.
Yeah, the sort of meta lore surrounding the Dark Lords and surrounding Ravenloft didn't exist yet. Strahd didn't exist in sort of this cosmic, in a place in the cosmos. It was just a village somewhere that was surrounded by mist. And he was just a vampire. He didn't have any connection to any, dark deities or dark powers or anything.
So by pure bad luck, you could just wander into Barovia back in the day and just have to go kill this immortal vampire who's got a...
Pretty much.
Yeah, okay. This is me trying not to say anything, troubling.
And there was a few nifty elements that they included in this adventure. One is the Taroka card reading. Taroka is kind of like the in-world version of tarot cards. So the idea is that when you're in the game, you can either before the game or during the game, you can do a tarot card reading. And depending on how the tarot card reading comes out, it will tell you where certain treasures are within Castle Ravenloft, treasures that will help you to defeat Strahd. The tarot card reading will tell you where in the castle you can find Strahd, because Strahd can kind of move around the castle at will. But this is where you know for sure you'll find him. Also Strahd's motivation. Strahd's motivation is determined randomly. How's that for control freak? Your villain's entire motivation is randomly generated.
I could not do that. Nope. He needs 18 pages of backstory that I've written myself, meticulously planned. I will not pull the fool out of a tarot deck and have to do that.
You get the fool, and his motivation is that he wants to become the world's premier stand-up comedian.
No, I can't do stand-up comedy.
Just nothing but vampire puns.
But Megan, they suck.
But this adventure introduced a lot of what would become the core elements to the Ravenloft setting. So it introduced Strahd himself. It introduced Barovia, the village where he lives, or the area where he lives. It introduces the mists as sort of a feature of Ravenloft. Yeah, and it introduced the Vistani. The Vistani are kind of the wandering nomadic peoples. There was a certain term that they used for them back in the 70s, 80s. We do not use that term today, but...
I got that vibe reading about them, and I was like, oh, this was clearly something else, and...
Yeah.
Yep.
So I just think of them as a wandering tribe of nomads, who are a very sort of insular community unto themselves, and they have the ability to travel sort of between the mists, through the mists at will. That's part of what makes them special. And they can also tell fortunes using their Taroka decks.
And Strahd lets them, it's one of the few people that Strahd just lets hang.
Yes, it varies from edition sort of what the nature of the relationship is between Strahd and the Vistani, but they have sort of a tentative alliance. Strahd kind of gives them free reign to come and go as they want.
It is not how he treats most people.
No. So the adventure was a big hit. It was it's still regarded as one of the top 10, original Dungeons, or at least first edition Dungeons & Dragons adventures of all time. And I wanted to point out one thing that kept popping up in the reviews, because I was looking at old reviews, reviews from the time, and one thing that people kept returning to is the fact that when you're in the crypts of Castle Ravenloft, a lot of the grave markers have names that are puns or plays on words. And they were complaining that it kind of breaks the atmosphere, that it's supposed to be this gothic horror adventure, but then there's these funny names. And I just wanted to read some of them to you to give you a sense.
Please, please do. I'm so excited.
So there's the crypt of an inventor named Americo Standardsky. Americo Standardsky, American Standard, the inventor.
Oh no, they killed the imperial system.
A winemaker named Artank Swilovich. Somebody named Lady Isolde Yunk, who's a junk dealer. Painter named Artista de Slop. A chef named Ardent Palette.
Well, fair.
somebody called Saint Finderway, this patron saint of lost travelers, somebody who doesn't have a name on their grave, just dollar signs. And the epitaph says, "We know him only by his money," which I think would be like, makes me think of like a rapper whose name is just dollar signs. And then this one was my favorite. Sir Cedric Spinwidovich, Admiral Spinwidovich. Confused though he was, he built the greatest naval force ever assembled in a landlocked country.
Oh, buddy.
That was my favorite one. I'm sure, I mean, looking through them, I wonder if maybe they were more punny at the time than they come off now. Like maybe something has been lost in the last 40 years.
I think they're great.
But those are the ones I could still recognize as being jokes. There might be others that are jokes that I don't get.
I can see why people at the time would have been like, this breaks the immersion. And I don't know if it's my storyteller brain working overtime. And I'm like, this sounds like a graveyard where Strahd puts people he didn't like. And these are not their names. This is just what he slapped on their graves. It's like artist de slop. He once did this horrible portrait of me, and I will not let him forget it even in death. So no one's down there. It's just this is where he came to practice all his stand-up comedy.
Oh, there you go. So this is when you get the fool. This is Strahd thought he was gonna invent a brand new comedy genre, comedic headstones, and it just never quite worked out. And that's why he's so evil. He's so bitter.
He's so bitter about it. It just didn't take off the way he thought it would.
But the adventure took off like a rocket and was super successful. So in 1986, they decided to create a sequel adventure, and it was called The House on Griffin Hill. It was also for AD&D First Edition. It was sort of created by Tracy and Laura Hickman. What I could find says that they wrote the outline for it, but then they left TSR. So Zeb Cook, Jeff Grubb, Harold Johnson, and Douglas Niles are the ones who actually wrote the adventure. It's another gothic horror adventure. But instead of being set in Barovia, it's set in a place called Mordant, where Strahd has either invented or he's found something that's called the apparatus that allows people to switch minds. So it's kind of like, it's sort of like Jekyll and Hyde, but if you put Jekyll in one body and Mr. Hyde in another body.
This sounds, I get where it would be gothic horror, but it also sounds like the plot to a vaguely supernatural sitcom.
It reminds me of the episode of Power Rangers where Billy and Kimberly switch bodies. But this adventure also introduced several mainstays for later Ravenloft lore. So it introduced the domain of Mordant. It introduced a lich named Azalin, who had become Strahd's sort of arch nemesis over the years. And it introduced the Weathermay family, which is like a family of monster hunters.
I feel like if you get two immortals in one vicinity, they're either going to be best friends or horrible enemies, and there is no in between.
Yeah, well, these two are horrible enemies.
Horrible enemies.
If you could switch, so if you had this apparatus that Strahd invents and you could switch minds, what D&D monster would you most like to switch minds with?
Keeping my clearly incomparable mental stats, my brain keeps going back to Owlbear, because on one hand, big, burly, dangerous, but a deep part of me just wants to hug. They look so fluffy and cute, and I will die hugging one. I don't know what campaign it'll be in, but it will happen.
But in this instance, you would be the Owlbear. So would you be hugging yourself, or would you be hugging other Owlbears?
Anything that is within hugging range is getting hugged. I imagine I will only give the best hugs.
What if you're a little like owlbear cub and you're with your other owlbear cub siblings all hugging each other?
Oh.
Just being a big soft pile of owlbear fluff. I don't know what I would want to switch. I struggled with this one. I mean, I think that most obvious thing to say is like dragon, because then you could be big and powerful and you could fly. Maybe like a kraken of some sort. I think that would be fun.
I have horrible thalassophobia, so
ow.
Do not put me anywhere near the ocean. I hate it. It's horrible. I don't know what's down there. I don't trust what's down there. And apparently what's down there is you.
I'm the opposite. I would go live on the bottom of the ocean if I could. I think it's wonderful.
The only thing protecting me from both sharks and dolphins is the fact that they cannot get to me on land. And the day that happens...
Protect you from dolphins?
Dolphins are frightening. I'm more afraid of dolphins than I am of sharks. Dolphins are smart.
I would like to be... Maybe I'll switch minds with a dolphin.
Oh!
I'll leave you alone, though. I would be a nice dolphin. I wouldn't chase you up on land and attack you.
Thank you. You're the one dolphin I can trust.
So the next development in the history of Ravenloft came in 1990. They created the Ravenloft Realms of Terror box set. This is for AD&D 2nd edition. It was written by Bruce Nesmith and Andrea Hayday. So this was the introduction of Ravenloft as a campaign setting. Up until then, Ravenloft had just been like sort of an isolated place that could, in theory, exist in any D&D world.
It's like a little puzzle piece you could just sort of slot into whatever you happen to be playing at the time.
Yep, exactly. Like if you're walking from one place to another and you just sort of stumble into Ravenloft or stumble into Barovia. In second edition, it was expanded and the other domains were created around Barovia. It included Mordant and Barovia, but they also created new domains, and each new domain got its own Dark Lord to rule over it. And this is where they created the concept of what in the old days is called the core. So the idea was that, like you said, with puzzle pieces, like all these different domains were sort of connected to one another, like puzzle pieces. So you could, in theory, just walk from one to another, to another, to another, unless, of course, the Dark Lord sealed it closed. But it was sort of a contiguous landmass, although it wasn't like a whole planet. Like eventually you would reach the end of it.
Okay, so it's a continent of just horrible things that can happen to you.
Yeah, like a continent floating out in the mist, basically. Not a fully functioning planet. And there was differences between each domain. So like one domain might have a white moon and the other domain would have a black moon. Another domain would have multiple moons.
And no one in the different dread domains, they're not aware of the other dread domains, are there? Are they? Or is it more
sort of? It depends. It depends on sort of the addition. It depends on the character. Like your typical just Ravenloft peasant doesn't really have this greater awareness, but you know, like adventurers and important NPCs and higher ups in the government or whatever, they're aware of, you know, the other domains. There is some kind of like trade and warfare between them and some commerce, but generally speaking, they're still kind of little places unto themselves.
Like Steve and Jim from Calicari and Borka, she said, picking random ones out of the book, are like chatting it up going, hey, my moon's white. Oh, well, my moon's black. That's weird.
Yeah, probably not. Or even if they had that information, instead of saying that's weird, they would just shrug their shoulders and be like, meh, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do, kid? It's Ravenloft.
So this was like a fantasy. This was a campaign setting that was kind of this fusion of fantasy and gothic horror. But it's also heavily influenced by what we think of as the universal monsters, like the original Frankenstein, Dracula, and also the Hammer horror films that came out in the 50s and 60s. Very heavily influenced sort of the feel of Ravenloft. It also introduced... fear and horror rules, which were a new thing to Dungeons and Dragons. The idea that as your character is being frightened or seeing horrific things, it sort of has a psychological effect on them. And I thought it was interesting. One thing I wanted to point out that was interesting is that apparently the Hickmans were not happy about the creation of Ravenloft as a campaign setting.
Oh, why not?
I think they just didn't like the idea of Strahd and Barovia being like part of this world. Like they thought Barovia should just exist as sort of a singularity rather than one of many. I think that's sort of the impression that I get.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And there would be some later controversy we'll get into in another episode, but eventually, ooh, in 1992, the first Ravenloft novel was released. It was called Vampire of the Mists. It was written by Christy Golden. When you're playing the original Ravenloft, I think they're kind of going for like, it's sort of like it's supposed to feel like Dracula's castle from the novel, but the story is more like the Bela Lugosi movie, with the idea of, like, you know, Tatiana is the reincarnate, or Irina is the reincarnation of Strahd's, of the woman that he loved, and she keeps getting reincarnated. That feels more Bela Lugosi to me. But in this novel, so this novel was written in 1992. And at the time, I think Anne Rice was like a big deal. So this novel, Vampire the Mist, actually feels to me much more like Interview with the Vampire than it does like Dracula. It's more about the relationship between two vampire characters. One is an elven vampire named Jander Sunstar, who comes to Barovia and meets Strahd, and they sort of form a friendship, but they also sort of hate each other at the same time. It's much more of like a character story and like a drama than it is like the sort of previous Dungeons and Dragons novels, which are more like adventure stories, like a group of heroes going off and having an adventure.
Enemies to lovers, slow burn.
Yeah. But I think that, I mean, I was reading some modern reviews, like, you know, people who have reread Vampire the Mist recently, and I myself reread it like a year ago, and it holds up pretty well. And I think the fact that it's so focused on the characters is part of what helps it to hold up really well.
Characters are an integral part, especially if you're going to have immortal characters. They kind of have to hold up, because characters essentially are immortal themselves.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And Jander, the original character created for the novel, but he actually still hung around because he was a fan favorite. So he persists. He's still in Ravenloft today. He's still stuck there.
Poor guy.
that's what really keeps you in Ravenloft, is when the fans want you to still be there. That's why you can never escape. In 1992, there was a second box set called Forbidden Lore by Bruce Nesmith and William W. Connors. Basically, this was a collection of five books of supplements to sort of increase the lore from the original box set. So there's rules for psionics, rules for curses, new spells, descriptions of societies and factions within Ravenloft, including one that's called the Keepers of the Black Feather, which is a group of like were-ravens that are oppose Strahd, and they're still in Ravenloft today. Actually, I think they're the only one of those that still persist. And then more information about the Vistani, and they added sanity rules, so you can now go insane if you see too much crazy stuff in Ravenloft.
When did Call of Cthulhu come onto the scene? Was it near this? Because Call of Cthulhu also has sanity rules, yeah?
Yeah, this would have been... Call of Cthulhu, I think, came out in the 80s, so Call of Cthulhu would have been first.
Oh, interesting.
Call of Cthulhu was not too long after Dungeons & Dragons was created. It's been around a long time, but it was definitely before this. So they probably were inspired by the sanity rules of Call of Cthulhu. And then in 1993... there was an adventure released for AD&D 2nd Edition that was called House of Strahd. And this was the first remake of the original Ravenloft module. The Hickmans are credited as the authors, but it's really just they took Ravenloft and updated it for the original Ravenloft and updated it for 2nd Edition.
I feel like House of Strahd is such a step down.
That's funny. Somebody else said the same thing. Like, one of the reviewers I said wrote like, Why would you take this iconic module and bury it behind a new name that nobody's going to recognize?
He's got a castle. He's got like a catacomb. Don't say house.
This House of Strahd.
Like, houses of peasants.
Duplex of Strahd. Timeshare of Strahd.
Terrace level apartment of Strahd.
It's like it's set in 22 and Strahd can only afford like a tiny studio apartment.
Oh, no, rent is real.
Barovia has been gentrified, and even Strahd is being Strahd is being forced out. He can't afford to live there anymore.
The rent is too damn high for Strahd.
It's like, you know, you don't make a whole lot of money just killing people and sucking their blood. It seems like a good deal, but you know, there's not a lot of money in it. I was reading reviews for House of Strahd too, and there's one that I really liked, because this is something that happens even in modern, you know, as somebody who likes to make maps and design settings for my homebrew games, this is something that I struggle with too. Maybe I struggle with it more than I really need to, but so let me read you this quote from a review of House of Strahd. It says, "The castle is fairly erratically designed with no functionality or reason behind some of the designs. It would be a nightmare to live in, having to go down two or three floors, then go back up through a different staircase just to reach the bedrooms. There are almost no living quarters or other locales for people to stay in. The castle with its odd rooms seems only fit for three people to live in at any given time. And this is something I struggle with, like when I'm making maps or like designing castles. It's like, well, if this castle is supposed to have, you know, a royal family living in it, as well as their retainers and all their servants and extended family, like, where are all the bedrooms? And then where's all the bathrooms for everybody? And how does everybody get around? Like, there needs to be like hallways that connect in some way that makes sense. So if you're the king and you need to go speak to, you know, your advisor or whatever, you don't have to go down two flights of stairs and down a hallway and then up another flight of stairs and turn left and up an elevator. And
every gothic map maker is just taking inspiration from the Winchester Mystery House and being like, yes, this will do nicely.
Yeah, like there doesn't, I mean, I guess strictly speaking, there doesn't really need to be logic in your D&D maps. You know, they just need to be fun to play in. But when you're somebody like me and you're just like obsessive about the details, you know, you have to include the bathroom. And yeah. How is, you know, where do the chimneys go? Like how is, you know, a certain room ventilated and things like that.
Also, never forget the bathrooms are a mainstay of horror.
I always put snake traps in the toilet in my horror adventures. Every time there's a bathroom, I put a snake in it and nobody ever opens the toilet.
It's just a real fear.
But if they do, one of these days, I'm going to get somebody with a snake in the toilet.
You won't get me.
And then in 1994, they released the second box set for second edition, which is called the Ravenloft Campaign Setting. It was written by Bruce Nesmith, Andrea Hayday, and William W. Connors. So basically what it did was it collected the two previous books, which are Realms of Terror and Forbidden Lore, and sort of smushed them together into one big book. And then it created also included a new book that was called Domains and Denizens that focused mainly on the different domains and the Dark Lords. So it was like an expanded campaign setting for Ravenloft, but it also was a little bit farther ahead in the meta plot. There is this big event that happens between these two editions. It's called the Grand Conjunction, where the Lich Azalin tries to like fuse all the realms into one, and then it almost works, and then it fails. And when it fails, it causes this catastrophe where like some of the domains that were part of the core get broken off and become their own little mini domains that they call Islands of Terror. And it was sort of like a cleanup effort. The idea was that they wanted the domains that were part of the core to feel thematically similar, like they are all, you know, European medieval type settings. Whereas the Islands of Terror, the ones that are separated by the mists, are kind of, that's where you can put like the different style of domains. So the mummy domain, which is kind of like an ancient Egypt type setting, is its own little independent island. And the Louisiana / New Orleans / Caribbean island is its own little setting. And like the Indian inspired domain is its own little setting, just to create it kind of like, make everything feel like they belonged together a little bit more. Does that make sense? Did I explain that well?
You did. I was just thinking you can see where they're trying to be better, but they're not quite there yet. Like, the core ones are still European, but you can have the diverse ones. They're still there. I was like, you're getting so close. You're doing so well. Just keep going.
I mean, that's kind of the theme of Dungeons and Dragons over the last 50 years. Like,
you're doing so well.
Slowly trying to do better. And sometimes you do a little better and sometimes you fuck up. But, you know, as long as you keep trying, I guess that's the most important thing.
That's the message here. Dungeons and Dragons, keep trying.
And special note, this box set is where I discovered Ravenloft. I had this box set back in the day. And I used to like read and reread and over and over. I played a lot of Ravenloft in second edition because for whatever reason, Ravenloft adventures were easy to find in my bookstores back when you used to go to bookstores. They would publish adventures at, you know, they'd publish like an adventure that took place in each domain, and they were pretty easy to find at my bookstore. And when I could afford them, I would buy them. So even when I was a teenager, Ravenloft was kind of what I was most running.
Fun fact about me, when I was younger, I was a coward. So I didn't get into horror until like my late teens, early 20s. So I don't have any stories from my past about horror because I was a coward.
So when I was young, I was obsessed with like, I was obsessed with like anything monsters, like anything Dracula, Frankenstein, Mummy, Wolfman. Like, have you ever seen the movie Monster Squad from the 80s?
This is going to turn into me having to disappoint you over and over again. No, I haven't.
Well, if you want to watch a really cheesy kids movie from the 80s, I highly recommend Monster Squad. It's like this group of little kids that like that this group of little kids that are all obsessed with monsters. And then Dracula and Frankenstein and Wolfman all show up in their town and they have to defeat them.
Oh, cute.
And I loved that movie when I was a kid. And I used to read like the Dracula for kids version. I had books about monsters and that's like. And I used to play, my favorite Nintendo game was Castlevania. So I was pretty primed for Ravenloft when I discovered it. I actually came to Dungeons & Dragons through Dragonlance, but it was through Dragonlance that I discovered Ravenloft. And once I found that, I was like, oh, this is wonderful. I love this. Yeah, I've always been a horror nerd. Ever since I was a wee child.
I am a recovering coward.
I'm going to make you watch some of my favorite stuff that you missed out on when you during your coward days, okay?
Yes.
And then we'll discuss it. We'll do an episode where we watch Monster Squad together and discuss it. How about that?
I love it.
And then let's see, 1997, Domains of Dread was released by Steve Miller, Cindy Rice, and William Connors. This was kind of the last version of the Ravenloft second edition settings. The final one that was published by TSR. And I don't really know much about this one. I never read this one. Based on what I've read, it's just sort of an amalgamation with some tweaks of the previous settings. But one thing that was introduced in this setting that I really love and that I use in my settings is a faction that's called the Church of Ezra. Basically, it's kind of like a church that spans all the different domains of Ravenloft. And nobody can agree on whether Ezra was a human or was a goddess. People can't agree whether Ezra was male or female, and people can't agree whether Ezra is even real or not. And I think that's just like the perfect religion for Ravenloft. Just this like confusing mess that, you know, people pray to Ezra, but Ezra doesn't really answer prayers. They have this religious hierarchy that's kind of just built on nothing.
No one knows what's going on and everyone's praying.
That feels so Ravenloft to me.
I love it.
Ravenloft. Oh, I just said the title.
Roll the theme music, we definitely have.
You know, I feel like one of the reasons I don't like to include gods in my horror settings is that if you know that you can pray to this god of infinite good and mercy to help you, you're not scared anymore, you know? But if your god's existence is highly dubious, then you've still got a good reason to be afraid, even if you're a believer.
The thing about horror is it has this weird relationship with hope. Mm-hmm. Wherein there has to be hope or there is no reason to be afraid because that's just depression, listlessness. But mm-hmm. if there's too much hope, there's also no reason to be afraid because, like you said, the God of infinite good is watching out for you. You have to have just enough hope.
It's kind of almost like the real world is its own horror setting, if you think about it in those terms.
Oh, don't say that.
You've got a little bit of hope, like maybe there's some point purpose to it all. But you don't really have any evidence that there's any purpose to it all. So you're kind of like, you're not really hopeful, but you're also not flooded with despair. You're just kind of existing. That's kind of Raven. That's so Ravenloft.
The real world is so Ravenloft.
But that, I mean, that's the reason, that's why I wanted to highlight the Church of Ezra. Because I use that in my campaigns because I think you can't have civilization without some kind of religion, but I don't want a religion that's like legit the way that the worship of the gods in other settings is, you know, and empirically provable.
Maybe Ezra's watching out for you. Maybe they don't even exist.
Maybe he, she, yeah. or they is, are. And then 2001, so 2000, by 2001, Wizards of the Coast had purchased TSR. And Wizards of the Coast did not want to publish Ravenloft third edition. So they licensed it to White Wolf, which is the company that also made Vampire the Masquerade.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah, so White Wolf published first a book that's called the Ravenloft Core Rulebook for third edition. So it was It was called Ravenloft 3rd Edition, but it didn't use the 3rd Edition D&D rules. It actually used the what's called the D20 system, which is kind of like obsolete now, but it was all the rage in the early 2000s. It was written by Andrew Cermak, John Mangrum, and Andrew Wyatt. They released a number of other supplements in true White Wolf fashion. They released like just the one book after another. So there was the core rule book and then Player's Handbook, then something called the Dread Realms, something called Champions of Darkness, Denizens of Darkness. But the main thing that's interesting about 3rd edition is that they published what are called gazetteers, which is like collections of lore that they published in like little mini books. And that was kind of how they fleshed out the lore. And gazetteers, people still do make like on DM's Guild, people still write their own gazetteers that are really interesting. It's kind of, they're kind of like mini campaign settings when you don't need a whole book for your campaign setting, just kind of a magazine sized campaign setting.
Oh, I love it.
Mm-hmm. And then 2006, they released in 2006, Dungeons and Dragons under Wizards of the Coast released Expedition to Castle Ravenloft by Bruce Cordell and James Wyatt. This is for D&D 3.5. This was yet another reimagining of the original Ravenloft adventure. This time it had no connection to the Demiplane of Dread, no connection to the Ravenloft campaign setting. It was sort of like the original where it could just exist in any setting that you wanted it to.
I love that. Another reimagining of Ravenloft. Imagine Ravenloft. Now imagine it again.
Well, there's another one coming.
Imagine it a third time.
I didn't play 3.0 or 3.5, so I don't have much experience with either of these, but I'll get around to reading them eventually. Oh, so speaking of reimaginings, there was no Ravenloft in 4th edition, but in 5th edition, 2016, they released Curse of Strahd. This was, again, a reimagining of the original Ravenloft adventure, although they expanded it to a full-length campaign. They made Barovia bigger, so instead of just being, basically before it was Barovia, the village, and Castle Ravenloft, and that's basically all there was, but they expanded it to have, you know, a lake and some mountains and some forests and some other villages that you could travel to. The story is kind of, and at its heart, the story is the same. You got to rescue Arena and kill Strahd to get out of Barovia. It's just bigger, just more to it. And it was a huge hit. A lot of people regard Curse of Strahd as the best module for 5th edition.
I do see it pop up a lot on Twitter.
Yeah, it is super popular even today. Even 6 years later, it's still super popular. They released an Adventures League campaign to go along with it. Sometimes it's just called Curse of Strahd Adventures League. Sometimes it's called Misty Fortunes and Absent Hearts. It's sort of like a parallel story.
Very different titles.
And then in 2020, they released Curse of Strahd Revamped, which is like a fancy collectible edition, but it's also meant to kind of clean up some of the problematic stuff that existed in the original Curse of Strahd. Like in the original Curse of Strahd, the Vistani are all like thieves and spies and drunkards. And they're like, super offensive to certain people, or just super offensive to people with a general sense of decency.
I'm personally offended that they called it revamped.
Oh, yeah? You don't like that?
How dare you?
Re-vamped.
Is that the one that came in the, like, it's like a coffin-shaped box?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, I do remember seeing that in the bookstore. And then my husband looking at it going, do I want that or do I just want the fancy box? I'm like, I don't know, but same.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a collector's edition, but it also, you know, fixes some of the stuff that's a bit off in the 2016 edition.
Fixes some of the things that are off for 2016.
Mm-hmm. Came a long way in 4 years, I guess.
We can only hope.
In 2021, Wizards of the Coast released Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft, which is the long-awaited full campaign setting for 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons. Until then, Ravenloft and Curse of Strahd is sort of like another microcosm type campaign. Like there's no Ravenloft setting supporting Curse of Strahd if you just play it rules as written. But Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft created the broader Ravenloft setting. It made a few changes that I think are good changes. It removed this idea of the core entirely. So like the continent that we talked about, like the continent with the islands floating around it, that's mm-hmm. gone. Everything is just its own little island floating in the snow globe.
It's all horrible.
Yeah. And they switched some of the characters around. So there's not a lot of, there's like one female or maybe two female Dark Lords in the original setting. So they reimagined some of the Dark Lords as female. So there's one who was like, there's one, I think he was called like Vlad Dracov in the original setting. He was basically like a Vlad the Impaler type Dark Lord. They made him a she in the fifth edition. They also made Dr. Victor Mordenheim, who is the Ravenloft version of Dr. Frankenstein. They made him a her. She is now Victra Mordenheim. And they even made the Frankenstein monster a female. She was a he in second edition and is now a Lady Frankenstein, a bride of Frankenstein, if you will. They brought back some of the characters, some of the Mistwalker characters like Jander Sunstar that I mentioned earlier. Azalin the Lich is now missing. They got rid of him. That's sort of like a whole meta plot unto itself. They brought back some returning characters. And then in 2021 also to coincide with the release of Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft, they released the Misthunter Adventures League, which is kind of like a misthopping campaign. So like each adventure takes place in a different domain of Ravenloft and you travel from one to another trying to solve this overarching grand meta mystery.
Detectives!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. The quest giver is like a Sherlock Holmes type character.
Love being a detective. I'm not good at it, but I love being a detective.
So that, in a nutshell, is the history of Ravenloft up until today, when you and I started talking about it. And then in 2022, the greatest development, Megan and Deanna made a podcast, and Ravenloft was changed forever.
Changed forever. Mm-hmm. Watsy, we are fully open to collaborating.
I'm sure they're listening and they're like, we've just been waiting for two girls to come along who can really create the setting the way that it needs to be. We've put aside so much money to pay them too.
So much money. we weren't expecting it to turn into a gothic romance, but I guess that's what the people want these days.
I mean, there's a lot of potential there.
So much.
If you want to do gothic romance.
All I want to do is gothic romance. All I want to do is kiss monsters.
the Victor Mordenheim and the monster are super queer coded in fifth edition. It's like it's clear they were a couple once upon a time. They don't outright say it, but if you're the slightest bit aware of queerness, you will pick up on it.
I love the image for Dr. Victor Mordenheim in Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft. It's such a beautiful image.
So do you have any last questions for me about the history of Ravenloft or any last comments or anything you want to say about anything?
Nothing other than I am super excited to dive more into it. Do we want to talk about what my actual job on this show is?
Oh yeah, I suppose we can talk about that if you'd like.
I didn't want to
spoil it for the next episode, but if you want to go ahead.
I do a little side hustle as a paranormal true crime researcher, so I am uniquely qualified to research monsters.
Yes, we are going to have a whole segment dedicated to monsters. So we're going to be talking about monster lore and monsters in D&D and all kinds of cool monster stuff, which I'm super excited for because, like I said, I love monsters.
I love info dumping about monsters on anyone who will listen to me. Thanks, Megan.
You're welcome. And so do you, you don't consider yourself beholden to this, but what monsters are we doing first?
I was thinking since we started with Ravenloft and we all know the most famous monster in Ravenloft is Daddy Strahd, figured we'd slip into the history of vampires.
Okay, so we will next time or whenever that is, you and I will get together and we will discuss vampires and we'll let you take the reins and I will follow along for the ride.
Oh, that's dangerous, but I can't wait.
All right, well, thank you everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you do all that stuff that I'm supposed to tell you to do, like and subscribe and leave us reviews if you're on Spotify or Apple. And this is episode one, and we will do many more episodes, and hopefully it'll become a long-term thing that people love. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Deanna.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm not just having you. It's your show, too.
Right. I'm here forever.
You're not a guest. You're a co-host.
So much power.
So thank you for being my co-host, and we will see you all next time.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
Oh, yes. Happy Halloween. Bye.
Bye.